The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Reports this afternoon suggesting that the Health Minister, Zweliem Kiese, has said that we are in a third wave, and he has urged provinces to take urgent mitigation actions in order to limit the spread of COVID-19. Get some perspective on that this evening. We'll talk about American inflation. We'll try and find out why it is that Prosus is buying a bigger stake in Naspers. It's very convoluted, but it affects us all as a result of the enormous size of Naspers on the overall market on the JSE. We'll also hear from Wendy Nola this evening. She is our consumer ninja. She'll be talking to us about complaints about the banks and how those are being resolved. And Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, looking at ESG investing, environment, society, governance, important factors in investing today. And wrap it all up this evening with the founder of Jack Black Beer, very, very successful brewing business in South Africa. And are they bracing for a third wave? All of that tonight on The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, the Health Minister, Zweliem Kiese, this afternoon telling provinces to gird their loins, announcing South Africa officially in a third wave of COVID infections. We've seen sharp rises in infections recently across many provinces. The Minister talking about intensive containment measures. Listening to that, leader of the Economic Intervention Group for Business for South Africa is Martin Kingston. How worried are you this evening with the trigger being pulled on third wave, Martin Kingston?
Well, Bruce, good evening to you and your listeners. We're worried about the third wave. We're not worried about additional restrictions or higher lockdown levels, which I know is where your question is directed. We're deeply concerned that the advent of the third wave, as it is occurring with the onset of winter, is going to present a very real risk to people's health, particularly the most vulnerable, and our healthcare systems. But we can't, as an economy, afford now to see any lockdown measures increased over adjusted level one, which is where we sit at the moment. And the most important thing we have to do, of course, is to accelerate the rollout of the vaccination program, which is commencing in earnest with phase two for the over 60-year-olds from Monday of next week.
When we look at the multiple issues that you've just raised there, the fact that we are in this accelerated level one and we can't afford to go to higher levels, government has in the past pushed for higher levels and higher restrictions, limiting access to alcohol, limiting access to public events, limiting access to restaurants. Is there an understanding between yourselves and governments that that cannot happen again, or is that just wishful thinking on your part?
Well, it is wishful thinking on everybody's part. There's no doubt that the sectors that you've mentioned have been extremely badly damaged, and the restrictions have been put in place with understandable motivation by government. At the moment, all of those facilities, other than mass gatherings, effectively, or mass events, as you characterized it, are open. Our borders are open. There's no restriction on movement, either interprovincial or otherwise. The problem is that we're going to be rolling out the vaccination program at the very same time. And if there was a desire to reduce movement, we would be constraining the ability for people to go to vaccination sites to be vaccinated. We don't think that that's a realistic prospect. We do think that, and we've advocated, that we need to cap the scope for indoor and outdoor gatherings. As business, we've said there shouldn't be more than 50 people indoors, no more than 100 people out of doors. And of course, the scope for indoor gathering is going to, again, be magnified as we move into winter. But the government, I think, has listened carefully to that. As far as the restrictions on restaurants and alcohol is concerned, that is in government's gift. We've been very clear in our regular engagements with them. We now have weekly engagements with government through NAT joints, which is the structure of government, that we need to be able to monitor these movements very carefully. And of course, my exhortation is not only that everybody who can registers for the vaccine and turns up to get the vaccine, but that we continue to observe the need for non-pharmaceutical interventions of masks, social distancing, and sanitization. And I think we've noticed a drop-off in all of those behaviours over the past couple of months,
I was out for a walk this morning, and I think 1 in 10 people were wearing masks, and it was just like, guys, I know you're outdoors and you think that you're invincible, but, you know, it's here. You've got to be careful, and people are just oblivious and fed up, I suppose. But yeah, there is time for that to be reinstated, of course. Zweli Mkhize, the comment that he makes, and he's quoted on News 24 this evening, saying that the numbers would not go down unless provinces started intensive containment measures. Intensive containment measures are three words which in one sentence imply tougher lockdowns.
Well, it does indeed, but as I said, we've had no such discussion with government at this stage. And the biggest problem that we have, of course, is that, as I indicated at the outset, the economy is not in a situation or a position where it can afford such restrictions, and government no longer has any fiscal flexibility to provide the type of support that it has provided over the past year. In fact, as we know, UIF TERS has effectively run out. That fund has been turned off for COVID support. Many of the other levels of intervention have either not been utilized or have also run their course. We cannot see a return to the increasing levels of unemployment that we experienced last year without devastating consequences, both for the economy and for society at large.
We've seen India underestimate the impact of its wave of COVID infections. Is there not a risk that, you know, in trying to preserve the economy, we run the risk of a runaway third wave? Are you not apprehensive about that based on what we're seeing in other parts of the world?
Yeah, we are apprehensive about it, and you're absolutely right to point it out. If we look at other examples, such as the UK has been under effectively very draconian lockdown measures, but they were able to do that by compensating in terms of providing the sort of level of support for the economy, both to small businesses and individuals, that we've not been able to do. I think that's the balancing act that government is going to have to consider. If it comes to having to choose, we, of course, will advocate harder and harsher lockdown measures until the third wave is passed. But the likelihood is that that is going to be with us for the next 2 or 3 months, Bruce.
Martin Kingston, thank you. At short notice, leader of the Economic Intervention Workgroup at Business for South Africa. Breaking news story this evening from the mouth of Zweli Mkhize, the health minister. He's warning provinces that the country is in the third wave of COVID-19, and that's the scary bit, intensive containment measures are required. That's from the health minister this evening, quoted by News 24. Another big story today, the US inflation number surging in April compared to a year earlier. Consumer prices there jumped 4.2% for the 12 months to April from 2.6 in March, and is the biggest increase since September 2008 in US inflation. It's a report from the US Labor Department. It comes amidst fears that the rising consumer prices could push up interest rates. That's the thing that the world is watching, of course. Some analysts saying the figures could be rising because of temporary factors like supply bottlenecks. We'll get Chris Stewart, our market commentator's views on that in a moment. But let's first talk Naspers.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, this is high grade stuff to kick off the Money Show this evening, because it affects each and every single one of us in one way or another, based on just how big Naspers is in our market, just how big Naspers will be in your pension fund and practically any other investments you have in South Africa. Prosus, the 2-year-old Amsterdam listing created to try and realize the value of the massive Chinese investment Naspers has in Tencent, is buying up shares in its parent company. That's quite convoluted, so let's simplify it. Prosus plans to buy up about 45% of the shares that exist in Naspers, and Basil Sgouros is the finance director at Naspers. Just explain to me, Basil, the thinking behind what for most of us looks like a very complicated deal.
Thank you, Bruce, and good to talk to you, and good to talk to some of the listeners today. Actually, at the core of it, the transaction is actually quite simple, and it's aimed at trying to solve a very unique and particular problem for Naspers, and that is that it today makes up 23% of the JSE SWIX. So what that means is every time the Naspers market cap goes up, most South African funds have to sell down because it pushes them above their prudential limits. And that's what we're trying to fix here. And the way we look to fix it is really quite straightforward. We offer NASPAS shareholders the opportunity to swap their higher discount NASPAS shares for lower discount Prosus shares, thereby unlocking immediate value on the day, but more importantly, align future value creation to accrete in greater proportion because Prosus trades at a lower discount. As a result of that structure, NASPAS's size of, on the switch will go down from 23% to 14%, which makes it far more manageable, but it will still remain South Africa's largest company on the JSE and still firmly in control of Prosus. So NASPAS remains SA domiciled, controlling Prosus, which represents the offshore investments.
Does that mean then that my pension fund has now got a capital gains tax problem? Because by selling the NASPAS shares into Prosus, they're going to register a profit, aren't they?
So a couple of things. First of all, most pension and mutual funds don't pay CGT.
Good.
So
yeah,
the bulk of South African shareholder base
won't. Okay.
Won't have,
but for everybody else, they will have to.
Yes, there are shareholders who will have a CGT impact. But there's a couple of things around that. First of all, it's not an extra tax. It's a tax that they'll eventually realize when they sell some NASPAS shares. Secondly, there's immediate value creation potential here. So that should go partly to funding the bill. And thirdly, the value creation over the longer term, if we continue to add 30-40% as we did last year in market cap, means that a greater portion of future value creation accrues, which should more than cover any potential CGT that happens up front.
Okay, so essentially, what we're doing is we're moving the NASPAS stake in Tencent from Africa to Europe. If I was to take it down to its barest essence, that's what's happening here, right?
Not really, because NASPAS remains the controlling shareholder of Prosus.
Yeah.
And ultimately, yes, Prosus is listed on the JSE. But what we're doing is we are right-sizing the two parts of the free float, right? The South African part through NASPAS and the Prosus one for the respective size of the exchanges. So NASPAS comes from 23 to 14%. And of course, the Prosus free float actually doubles. It gets to $100 billion on the Euronext. And both those sizes are the right size for the respective exchanges, which allows for better trading dynamics around NASPAS and Prosus. And ultimately, because Prosus is a subsidiary of NASPAS, that also benefits NASPAS shareholders, even those who don't tender shares.
So what are you hoping this will achieve? It'll push up the share prices of both NASPAS and Prosus because the value of Tencent in China will be more attractive to investors in Prosus than it is perhaps in NASPAS at the moment.
That's actually well put, Bruce. And indeed, in fact, that will be the net effect of this. Now, of course, it's going to take time because the transaction only closes in the third quarter. And then it plays out from there. But that would be what actually happens over the longer term, yes.
We certainly hope so. Basil Skordos, thank you. He is the finance director of NASPAS.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
On to Chris Stewart. Chris Stewart is a portfolio manager at 91. That NASPAS process story in words of single syllables or less and sentences no longer than three words. Explain, please, Chris Stewart.
Confusing, I think, is three syllables, Bruce, and certainly less than three words. But, yeah, we saw the announcement out this morning. I think the market maybe viewed it as positive, but a lot of, I think, the strength in the share price we saw in this morning, both NASPAS and Prosus, was really a carryover from last night's relatively strong performance from Tencent. As the day transpired, the market unraveled the transaction a bit and figured at the margin maybe good for Prosus and possibly immediately less good for NASPAS, and that's largely got to do with the fact that there may be some natural buying of Prosus. As Prosus's free float increases, there may be some natural selling of NASPAS as NASPAS's free float decreases somewhat. And as a consequence of that, we saw ending the day Prosus performing reasonably well, NASPAS performing somewhat less well. But I guess the hope is that in increasing the free float of Prosus, increasing its index weighting in Europe, increasing its tradability in Europe, hopefully processes inherent discount at which it trades to its underlying stake in Tencent should narrow somewhat. And Naspers will remain a significant shareholder in Prosus. And as a consequence, theoretically, then Naspers shareholders should also benefit at least from the fact that the Prosus NAV discount narrows, albeit the discount at which the underlying Prosus share trades within Naspers may not narrow at all.
In simple terms, in order to buy the discount that exists in Tencent, for example, you're not going to have too many people taking their money, putting it in South Africa to buy Naspers, but you may very well find people willing to put their money into Amsterdam to buy Prosus. And that's why this very convoluted sort of structure is emerging.
You may do, although, you know, they haven't necessarily yet. The Prosus discount has remained stubbornly wide, albeit narrower than it has been historically. And, you know, does an increased tradability, increased index weighting, increased free float dramatically change the discount that the market has been prepared to pay for that asset, given the fact that some of the shareholding structures and voting shareholding structures that still remain in place will continue to remain in place in the future? That'll remain to be seen, I think, Bruce.
And then Transaction Capital, it's an SA Inc. favorite, and they're just, you know, they're looking to buy more of We Buy Cars. We're going to talk to them in 10 minutes' time. But it's a great story, and they're performing really nicely.
Yeah, I mean, it's a favorite with good reason, Bruce. This is a business that has managed very well through the COVID crisis, and that since listing has got an exemplary track record in terms of delivery. They have again delivered good results for this period, now showing growth for the 6 months to March of this year versus the 6 months to March of 2020. In other words, if you like, a post-COVID six-month period versus a pre-COVID six-month period, still showing good growth on a year-on-year basis and showing exemplary growth from the We Buy Cars acquisition. They've acquired 49.9% of that business. They're keen to go to just below 75% as soon as possible. And within a very short space of time, that business has grown to be contributing almost 25% of the group's bottom line. Not to say the other two businesses, SA Taxi, the taxi finance business, as well as Transaction Capital Risk Services, the distressed debt acquisition and collections business, those businesses have both performed well in the current environment. The taxi business did suffer something of a non-performing loan issue last year, as one would expect any credit provider would have during that period. Collections now starting to improve quite materially. The non-performing loan ratio is starting to come down, and the collections business has migrated well from a massive call center business to a work-from-home business. They're back in the market acquiring distressed debt books, and it looks as though the collections activity within that business is going well as well.
Okay, good. And then finally, how worried should we be about today's American inflation number? Is it just because inflation was incredibly low in April and May last year that today's number looks so big, hairy and scary? Or is this the beginning of what everybody's been waiting for, which is a higher trend in American inflation?
Well, it looks as though it's the beginning of a higher trend. Is it a transitory higher trend or a higher trend that's going to be sustained, I guess, is the question. It does look from the number. I've had a quick look at the numbers today. It does look as though it's fairly widespread. You know, inflation coming in month on month at 0.8% versus 0.2% expected, and year on year at 4.2 versus 3.6 expected. So it's a big inflation beat. U.S. market's not taking it particularly well. Most of the indices there, but down between 1% and 2%. U.S. bonds obviously selling off, so that U.S. 10-year up at 168 odd. So and the dollar strengthening. So all the characteristics you would expect from this inflation beat coming through in the market. As I say, it looks quite widespread. The question mark is how much of this is temporary supply constraints as a result of COVID resulting in bottlenecks and as a consequence of that price increases. Also, how much of it is in response to, I guess, temporary stimulatory measures as a result of some of the COVID relief programs that have come through supporting consumer demand in the short term. Both of these factors may normalize inflation, may then become the temporary aberration that I guess risk markets are hoping that it is. But time's going to tell on that one, Bruce.
Chris Stewart, he is a portfolio manager at 91.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield, 21 minutes to 7. David Hurwitz standing by, Chief Executive at Transaction Capital. Coming up next time on The Money Show, the personal finance expert Warren Ingram sharing some tips on whether you keep your money in the country based on a strong rand or whether you really do need to be looking at offshore. We've seen the rand strengthen this week, moving to its best level in 16 months thanks to strong commodity prices. Just how long can it last? Or could it get better? Pablo Fatidis at Auric Business Accelerator, looking at small business, plus all the big money stories of the day.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
We see food price inflation in South Africa, of course, is quite a big and serious issue. Today, Karen Richards, one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter, was saying that the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations has tabled a bunch of statistics about world food price inflation. And Karen's observation is it continues to rocket. The Food and Agricultural Organization Food Price Index rose 30.8% over the last year. So it's up 30.8% on this time last year. Things like vegetable oils are nearly twice the price they were last year. Sugar up 58%, cereals up 26%, and dairy up 24%. Our food price inflation isn't quite at that level, but those sort of statistics are absolutely terrifying. And it is, I'm sure, connected to global supply chains. And the fact is that its global trade is that much more restricted than it was 18 months ago, and hence why it is so difficult, of course, to keep a lid on prices.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
What's that joke about Mackenzie Bezos when she was married to Jeff Bezos and she said to him, please won't you pick up the Wall Street Journal on the way home? And he misunderstood and he bought the entire company. You could apply that to Transaction Capital. David Hurwitz is the chief executive of Transaction Capital. Did someone in your family ask you to buy a secondhand car on the way home, David Hurwitz, and you went and bought a bigger stake in We Buy Cars?
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for the comparison to Bezos.
But of course, you're on the way. You're on the way.
We're very excited about this. We see a few things about We Buy Cars. First of all, the industry or the sector must be one of the hottest sectors in the world right now. Secondhand cars sales have grown all around the world while new car sales have reduced. And this whole concept of applying e-commerce into the secondhand vehicle market is still growing. And for that reason, we were really, really excited about the opportunity to increase our stake.
Because in September last year, you took 49.5%. You want to take that now up to 75%. I mean, have you just watched magic happen in the last 6 months that gives you the confidence to take another big chunk?
So I think we've seen a few things. We've seen the resilience of the business through COVID. Growing right through, it grew dramatically in 2020 despite losing 3 months to COVID. We've seen a great management team. We love working with founders who are heavily vested and they'll hold the remaining 25%. So all of that we really like. I've spoken about the sector. But in truth, this decision was pushed by them more than us. They believe that there's a huge opportunity to increase unit economics if we can provide finance and insurance more wholesomely into that business. And of course, that's where we are specialists. So that's what we'll bring to the party. Of course, we'll keep on being a broker. We do have all the banks and certain insurers on the floor. So we'll keep on doing that. But we think there's an opportunity to do better with those relations and also to offer finance and insurance as a principal.
And this is, the lessons that you've learned through financing taxis. I think you still finance about 15% of South Africa's minibus taxis on the road. And, of course, through financing them and insuring those, you keep a firm grip, at least on that 15% of the taxi industry. So those lessons then getting applied into the We Buy Cars transaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the one kind of... competitive advantage that we would have just in terms of going into finance in the second-hand market is that if we do have to repossess a car, we have a platform such as We Buy Cars that is selling second-hand cars every day. So to the extent that you repossess, you know, you can really liquidate that loan very quickly, where the banks have to hold these cars for a period of time and then move them into auction houses. You know, we'll save a lot of time and hopefully get better prices without leaking margins. So I think we've got good credit skills and We Buy Cars and collection skills, and We Buy Cars has fantastic ability to understand the value of a car and to liquidate on that value if need be.
Because the third part of the third leg on the pot, so to speak, is debt collection. And that has been must have been a really interesting space over the last 12 months, especially in the initial stages of the crisis where people's salaries stopped immediately. And you must have seen an explosion in bad debts. And did that lead to you buying up credit books and then collecting on those yourselves? How have you operated?
So, Bruce, we've operated really well, but I must say there were a lot of surprises in that space. So the first thing is, just as you said, you would have expected an explosion of bad debt, which did happen, but none of it came to the market for us to work on, either as an agent or a principal, because what the banks did is they said, well, you know, we're not going to ask you for your money, we're not going to collect, and for that reason, we won't sell the book to people like Transaction Capital, and we won't even outsource it for collection. We'll just wait and see. And to some extent, they've created these, they call them rescheduled or restructured books, and they're still waiting to see how the consumers perform. So that was one surprise. That being said, we've seen volume start to pick up quite nicely now. The other thing that surprised us on the upside is that the consumer was really resilient during COVID, and our collection rates, we thought they would be dramatically down. They didn't drop more than 30% down, and they're currently at about 95% of what they were pre-COVID. So what's that, 5% down? So, you know, collection revenues really, really were good. What we did is we aggressively trimmed our business and cut costs, et cetera. And what we saw for our growth result is that revenues grew by about 8%, but costs only grew by 1% or 2%. So that really was the real thing we saw there. So I'm very happy with that result.
And you talk about all three of these businesses being at pretty much back to pre-COVID levels, which is something quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's really extraordinary. If we look at TCRS, I'm using 2019 as a base. From an activity perspective, we're back to pre-COVID levels. We, as I said, handovers or matters flowing into our business are slightly down. But if we look at earnings was 11% above 2019. If we look at SA Taxi, their collections are still slightly below, also in the 90s. And interestingly, as in December, we were in the high 90s. As we went into January, into lockdown level 3, we dropped to 87. So I would have expected a bigger drop, but it wasn't. And I'd see if a third and fourth wave comes, collections can vacillate between 87 and high 90s. So I don't see any big impact there. And SA Taxi were able to grow profits above 2019 by 4%. So a real good mixture of our businesses recovering to above 2019 levels. And then, of course, the investment from We Buy Cars adding 113 million rand to earnings.
Well, the health minister, William Keyes, has been quoted tonight by News 24 as saying that the third wave is here and urging provinces to take urgent mitigation measures. You worried about that?
Yeah, I agree. It's upon us. I would expect we don't have to change anything operationally. We've done all the operational changes to our business. But I would obviously economic activity will dip, commuter mobility and movement will dip. And what we've done is we have provided for that, and we'd expect kind of this vacillation certainly in taxi between high 80s to mid 90s. In TCR, it's a very similar type of thing. Revenues vacillate up and down by about 7 or 8%. So it's not as dramatic as what we saw before, because I think just as we have adjusted operationally, so too has the rest of the country. We've provided for that type of movement. We haven't provided for a full lockdown, but we've certainly provided for movements between level 1 and 3.
You're still resisting the urge that may or may not exist to offshore your business to find new revenue sources outside of the country. It must be tempting at 14 to the dollar with the rand at 16-month highs. Many South African companies, of course, over the last decades have expanded. Some have done well. Most have burned through a lot of cash. You are resisting that temptation.
Yeah, I mean, you know that we invested into Australia about four or five years ago, and that investment has worked really well. But it was a small investment. We spent 33 million Aussie dollars, plus there was a little bit of a warranty payment thereafter. Maybe we got to about 40 or so. So, you know, nothing earth-shattering for a business with a 20 billion rand market cap. We've bought a few books. Looked to buy a few books in our collections business in Europe, and we'll cautiously look around it. But I think the real opportunity for global expansion will be through We Buy Cars, where if you look at some of our international peers, we compare very favorably to them, and most importantly, we make profit. Most of them don't. They've got high growth in revenues, as do we. High growth in e-commerce trade, as do we, but they're most of them are still loss-making, and, you know, we are making a decent profit. So I think there could be an opportunity to for some global expansion in that side, but one thing at a time. Let's first conclude agreements, let's then wait for ComCom, and then we'll take a look at conquering the rest of the world, Bruce.
One step at a time. Thank you, David Hurwitz, the Chief Executive at Transaction Capital. Fabulous story.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Now, we all know that there was a huge explosion in online shopping last year. Nothing surprising about that, considering that many of us who hadn't really bothered with online shopping actually did. We went online, and on South Africa's online retail sector, leapt to 30 billion rand. A big increase. But still, Brian Turner, who's a data analyst at Worldwide Works, which carried out the research, online shopping is still minuscule compared to the extraordinary appetite we've got for mall crawling.
So mall crawling did pick up when the lockdown lifted, but online shopping has definitely become a learned behavior since the lockdown onset. And we noted some startling revelations from our stats this year. When we looked at our 2018 data, it was generally almost known that the older consumers, 45 and above, weren't going to be shopping online. But this year, they're far more likely, and in some cases, as likely to shop online as our younger consumers.
Well, it's still an overall percentage of the total retail of only 4%. I mean, yes, it's double what it was a year or two ago, and I suppose that's to be celebrated. But I would have thought it would have gone to a far higher percentage of total retail. Turns out it didn't.
For sure, and that is made largely a function of bank readiness. So a lot of banks like to say that they are ready for getting their customers onto digital platforms. But the fact of the matter is that many consumers, one, either don't have the money to shop online, or two, don't have the right card to shop online, because there are many cards in circulation that just aren't enabled for online purchases. And that's a huge prohibitive factor in getting South Africans shopping online.
I mean, that's quite astonishing, really, considering how advanced our banking system is supposed to be.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, the traditional banks are still traditional banks. And we can't comment too largely on that. We could rather comment on how online people are rather than how not online people are.
How are the online retailers then reshaping themselves? How are they changing? Every small business luxury provider of a product or a service has told us how they made the switch to online, and they can't believe the huge increase in sales that they've seen. And then, from a corporate perspective, we've seen a huge boost to their online sales, whether from Mr. Price to Checkers and the 60-60, for example, concept, which was launched during lockdown to great acclaim.
So yes, for sure. Taking into example the Checkers 60-60 app, it all comes down to friction. And when we look at something shopping online versus shopping in person, shoppers in person are less likely to abandon their cart. But when you're shopping online, you can leave the website if there's too many clicks, too many taps, too many scroll actions. then you can pretty much leave your card with no consequences. So all of these providers, and Checkers has done this spectacularly well with getting their 6060 app with as few taps, as few scrolls as possible. And that's ultimately what made their success. And the same is going for many online retailers who are trying to get people out of their store checked out with the product. And that is the holy grail of shopping online. And businesses have had to learn that in the recent lockdown.
I mean, are retailers then getting better at online?
Definitely. So as these numbers reflect, at least the larger retailers are getting a lot better. And in our future projections, we're going to see steady growth throughout this year and next year. And that's largely because the vaccines haven't been distributed enough yet, and not a lot of people feel safe to be outside and out and about and in social situations yet. But the convenience that's attached to it will definitely stay with many consumers.
And the dominance of the Takealots of the world, have they consolidated their dominance, or have they seen more competition come in and actually corrode their dominance?
So it's a bit of both. Because Takealot is a household name, they would have quite a large share in our online retail landscape. But it's also quite comforting to see the likes of Facebook and Instagram, Instagram in particular, launching shops on profiles. So young consumers don't even have to set up a website anymore. They can just, jump onto Instagram, make a few products. It's dead simple in Instagram, and then sell via that platform. So it's all becoming far less friction. It's getting far less friction than before, which is great.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed. Brian Turner, data analyst at Worldwide Works. Thank you for joining us this evening on The Money Show. Online shopping boomed. It was really nice to see. And they looked at this. They've done this and they say online retail for South Africa came to 66% growth, brought a total of online sales to 30.2 billion rand. And it's more than double the 14.1 billion reached in 2018. Just 2 years. And a pandemic led to a doubling in online retail. The trick now, and this is going to be so interesting about next year's research, is to see whether or not it grows from here, whether the habits of online stick or not.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Colin Cullis is ready for us on line this evening. Looking forward to chatting to him in Business Unusual. We got Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja. She's looked at the statistics from the banking ombud today, all about customer complaints in the banking sector. And there's been a turn up for the books in terms of who has had the most complaints and who's the biggest improver. What does it reflect? What does it really mean? Then 7:30 this evening, our shapeshifter is the founder of Jack Black Beer. A far bigger array of beers in my research than I had initially anticipated. Ross McCullough, the co-founder of Jack Black Beer, which has survived not one but two crises so far. We'll pick up with him coming up on The Money Show at 7:30.
The Money Show.
Business Unusual.
With Colin Cullis.
I think there was a perfume in the 1990s called ESP, extra sensory perception. And people, I'm sure, would love to have extra sensory perception when it came to investing in stock markets. But I don't think that's a strategy. What is a new strategy, Colin Cullis, is this idea of ESG. It's more fragrant, I think, than even ESP ever was.
More sustainable, Bruce, I think, is what they're going for. And it wouldn't typically fit into the what I would normally pick up on Business Unusual, because I usually look at things that weird things that businesses are doing that are coming down the track for us as consumers, or new businesses that are disrupting the way we've typically worked with things. This one kind of goes the other way around. It's something that has come from people looking to disrupt the way businesses operate. And so typically capitalism has relied on the notion that you get an amount of money, you want to create a service or a product, you sell it to people for a maximum profit, and then those profits are shared amongst the company and its investors, and everybody's kind of happy. But that's turned out to not be a very clever way for sustainability. And certainly a younger generation, kind of skeptical that older generations didn't sort of use the planet a little bit willy-nilly are now facing all sorts of things from climate change, health pandemics, and economic crises just in their relatively short lives, assuming these are the ones, the millennials. So they're only about 50 years old right now, and they're thinking, wow, we've really seen quite a bit. We may have avoided a few world wars, but no doubt they feel like they have had a really tough time. So a quick recap then of the kind of investments that were related to these. Back in the mid-90s, the idea of a triple bottom line became popular, with the regular bottom line simply being profits. And then you wanted to add these additional bottom lines for characterizing how well a company was doing by how well it looked after its people and how well it looked after the planet. Everybody loved the idea. Nobody knew how to measure it. Or rather, people just made up how they were measuring it and said, we're fantastic with triple bottom line. Marketing departments are happy. Investors, not so much. Then came socially responsible investing. And that still is a very big thing. But what it is characterized by is that investors or funds seek to avoid any companies that don't align with their values. So it doesn't seek to ask companies to do good things. It simply seeks to avoid the ones that they don't like. So if you or the fund or the pension you're with says, listen, we don't want to invest in gambling, then your fund simply avoids any companies that have anything to do with that. There is no pressure on a gambling company to reform its ways or to become more sustainable or better in that way. And then the most sort of ardent version of this sort of type of investments is impact investing. And there the investor is looking to forego a return for the investment of having something in society be improved. So this includes sort of investments in nonprofits, where effectively you're saying, I'm not going to get my money back. But as a result of the work that, let's say, Gift of the Givers do, there'll be fewer people who are in abject poverty or without any access to the most basic things. I'd like to say that impact investing should be what citizens do or expect from their taxes. Unfortunately, they don't quite get that kind of return. But maybe one day we can all refer to taxation as impact investing, which brings us then to this one, the environmental, social, and corporate governance type, which is, you know, similar to the socially responsible investing. But rather than saying we're just going to forget about anybody we don't like, they look to engage all of the companies to say, have a look at the impact on the environment and on society and on your governance, and let everybody get a little better and a little more sustainable, so that sort of everything gets improves that way. And its history is quite interesting, because the UN Millennium Development Goals, which were launched in 2002 for the purpose of ending extreme poverty by tackling 8 key areas that would keep people that way. Now, while those were aimed at governments to look to do their part, the UN obviously understood that without businesses, there is a lot more that would need to be done. The plan was to have that achieved by 2015, but given that the UN is ostensibly politicians, when they failed to achieve that, it became the Sustainable Development Goal. So we're still looking to do them. We've just sort of extended the time period. But to the credit of Kofi Annan, who was UN Secretary General at the time, he in 2000 had sought to create this global compact to invite businesses to sign up to become more socially responsible corporate citizens. And in 2004, he created this idea of the ESG investing by asking specifically for the integration of environmental, social, and corporate governance factors into capital markets. And this is kind of how we got to where we are now. But most recently, the champion, certainly for the last 2 years, and has, I think, been responsible for a very big part of its adoption, has been BlackRock's Larry Fink. Featured him last year. He became known for his annual letters to the CEOs, probably as influential these days as Warren Buffett's sort of investor relations and giving his take every year, which he started writing after the financial crisis in 2008. Last year, the focus he put is that our companies need to address the impact we're having on our climate and get to net zero. And this year, he is talking about the growth in funds and the need for companies to be able to align for investors who want to invest in these ESG type funds. He takes two broad categories. One, the millennials, because they don't want a quick buck and that's going to cost them the planet. And very large investors who ultimately would like to see that wealth sustained for generations beyond themselves, then be a sort of a one-hit wonder with them and then disappear a little down the road. So while ostensibly this is for investors, whether it be in individuals or funds or pensions, a very big part of it, It's ultimately for a company's own benefit. The likelihood of you being able to receive funding, certainly sustainable funding for new projects and new ventures, is probably going to be based on whether or not you are aligned with us, because most of the new capital that seems to be coming available is aligned with this ESG type stuff. Yeah. And then, of course, it's good for, you know, just regular Joe public and the planet in large. The tricky part, though, is how we go about determining it. And this remains something that is not quite yet resolved. So I suspect in the next couple of years, as money goes sloshing towards it, there's basically an opportunity for companies, the good data quant type crowd, and then the actual investors, asset managers and the like, who are going to be really testing those CEOs come reporting time to start quizzing them about their various factors. The broad-based things, and one company that has been doing quite a lot with this has been MSCI, who put together an index now, and they list for the environmental stuff, carbon emissions, water consumption, land use, toxic emissions, packaging, electronic and material waste, and energy consumption. That's how it relates to the environment. For society, human capital, supply chains, product quality and safety, privacy and data security, and ethical sourcing and transparency. And then for governance, these are the ones that are a little more well-known: pay structures and incentives, accounting, anti-competitive practices, business ethics, corruptions, and instability, and tax compliance. And one of the things that I didn't realize about what it was looking to do is that a company that, for example, was embroiled in some or other low-level scandal or mid-level sort of corruption thing would actually mark them down on this ESG type ranking and index. So that even if you weren't following it and knowing exactly what their business is doing or the cyclical range of the markets, the fact that their corporate governance might be a bit wanting suggests that probably at some other point they're going to falter, they're going to miss a product launch, they're not going to deliver a product with the same quality, they're not going to get the marketing right. And so somewhere else along the line, they'll stumble or they'll look to try and cover something up. So the fact that it isn't just looking at, you know, what profit did you make, which is a very simple thing for us to measure, does suggest that this is actually a more comprehensive way of evaluating a company and spotting the things that maybe would be considered, well, let's not worry about that in the short term, when they actually turn out to be massive things longer in the longer term. And I'm reminded, for companies maybe like a Steiner for something, there probably have been elements in their reporting that looked a little fiddly, but not necessarily the bottom line. So I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure they'll take care of it. Yet this would have been the sort of little canary in the mine to warn us of what's potentially coming. And again, MSCI's sort of rating uses the same ones that the rating agencies do. So there are seven of them, from AAA, AAA, BBB, BBB, and CCC. CCC being sort of laggards, as they call them. The B's are average, and the AAA or the A's are the good guys. And so I went to go and have a look at their ranking. There's a lovely little tool online. I'll put it in the article I post as well, for you to go and check a company and to see what their rating is. And I figured I'd take the FANG group of companies, because those are the ones I generally blather on about the most. And they're all in the B's. Facebook comes in at a flat B. Apple comes in at a BBB. Amazon, BBB. Netflix, BBB. And Google, BB. And that's only recently. They've just gone down. They used to be an A. In South Africa, I was impressed, I think, to say that Naspers is an A. And Standard Bank, a double A. So there is some good sort of principles and things that are happening in South Africa in this regard as well, to have some of those companies already ranking so highly on the index. The other
Colin Cullis, sorry. I thought you were done. Forgive me. Have a last thought.
So the last element I'd mention is that while the measurements are still a bit of a challenge, the large auditing firms have had a sort of a very dodgy decade. And so, again, the smaller companies looking to embrace these sorts of principles, use the very clever data scientists to interrogate reports and to Winkle pick the stuff out, would both have an opportunity to contest with some of those large auditing firms and to provide these sorts of reporting, as well as compel those large audit firms to stop being prepared to look the other way and sort of just, you know, do what they can to keep somebody happy by including all of these things. And it is very simply encouraging to see that, because there's more investment done on this and there are efforts to make it easier for people to be able to create metrics for this, then perhaps Pavlo might even weigh in us on the soon, because small businesses looking to get access to capital markets, assuming that as a small business, it's the easiest for you to adopt sustainable principles, to adopt these sorts of ESG type metrics, would get access to a massive wealth of funding, which could set you up to be the next big, disruptive, incredible business, rather than having to languish while the incumbents sit and take all your money or wait for you simply to be taken over. So it looks like a very encouraging way. We are a long, long way to go. But this is one of the places where the disruption seems to be better than not. And if I look at our listeners, I asked them ahead of the show, what do you want from investments? Their options were show me the money, 42%, do no harm and a profit, 10%. And thankfully, just squeaking in with 47% were do good and a profit.
Do good and a profit. That would be nice. Thank you. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual. Wendy Noda, we'll catch up with her in a moment. Wendy is our consumer ninja. She is looking at the latest reports on complaints from you about your banks.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
Well, it's a Wednesday night, which means our consumer ninja, Wendy Noda, is ripe and ready to take us through issues that interest you from a consumer perspective. And every year, the Banking Ombud, Wendy, publishes a whole report on complaints in the banking sector. The banking sector now, just to summarize very quickly, if you've got a complaint with your bank, you go to your branch, you file a complaint, and if it gets resolved, the Banking Ombud never gets to hear about it. That's banking right. Ombud is like the place of last resort. These are only serious cases that go to the Ombud. On average, it seems to be sort of 50-50 year on year, which cases get resolved in favor of the customer and the bank.
No, actually, with all the financial services Ombuds, Bruce, it tends to be far more in favor of the bank or the insurer than the consumer. The explanation given for that is, and it is an international thing with their counterparts across the world, is that the complaints handling divisions sort of on first getting the complaint from the Ombuds tend to try and stop it from becoming a formally opened case. So they will settle a lot at that stage. Only if they don't, the more sticky cases get to go, get open for full assessment by the adjudicators. And that's why you have, it's actually this year, it's 70-something percent in favor of the banks, and 72 cases in favor of the banks and the remainder in favor of the consumer. What was particularly significant, now this was 2020's annual report, right? 2020 was the Ombuds Office 20th anniversary, and they thought the year was going to be about celebrating that, and of course it became about COVID. But they had an advantage in that they were quite forward-thinking with their employment practices, and already the adjudicators were working on a rota system 2 days from home. So they had all the technology they needed at home to spend those 2 days working from home. So they just very easily adapted to working 5 days from home in the beginning of hard lockdown in March, and then they scaled it back. But they're still working at many companies several days a week at home. Anyway, so that made them very productive. So they opened something like, quite a bit more cases in 2020 than they did, 19% more cases in 2020 than they did the previous year, which is quite good. But interestingly, the converse happened. Their stats in terms of turnaround time, how many days they took from opening to closing the case, went up. It was 67 days, just over 2 months, and that was because the banks' responses were delayed, responses to their communications around their clients' complaints, because they took a while to settle into the new ways of working. And it's not a little interesting 2020 story there. But for me, the biggest takeout, Bruce, was looking at the number of cases that were open for each bank in 2020 as compared with 2019 and 2018, and particularly between 2019 and 2020, because there was a rather dramatic, worrying spike in the number of cases opened in the case of FNB as well as Capitec. So they had a lot of clients that they upset and annoyed last year. So, for example, in 2019, there were 1,707 F&B cases. 2020, 2,197. Sure. Capitec also, about, almost doubled, 1,259. Up from 763 the year before.
I mean, one wonders what the reasons were, and possibly COVID-related. The fact is that, different institutions responded differently to the lockdowns and the crisis.
Possibly. But a lot of it is actually the way complaints were dealt with. In other words, speaking, having to tell your story six times and getting a different person each time, not having sufficiently trained people to deal with disputes and that sort of thing. So that's a big part of what leads the person actually to take the complaint to the Ombud, because they just aren't getting anywhere with their bank. Something that I see APSA has put out a release, they've got a lot to crow about, because their numbers dramatically dropped from 2019. So they had 1,483
cases. Okay. The absolute numbers, Wendy, matter less than anything else. Just the trends are interesting. So Capitec and FNB spiking. The APSA pulling back very significantly. So far fewer complaints than in previous years. I was once on a panel discussion. I wasn't invited back. And Rudy Lutman was chairing it. And I was on the panel as a guest. And I thought the panel was getting a bit dull. So I turned to the then banking ombud, knowing the answer to the question, and said to him, so which bank last year had the most complaints? And he looked at me as if I had just said something terrible about his mother, and then went, well, APSA. And we're in a room with like 5,000 APSA managers. And there was this hiss and this boo. And I looked at the audience and I said, well, I happen to know the answer to that question. You knew the answer to that question. You just don't like the answer to the question. Can you fix it, please? And I'm delighted that they seem to be doing so.
They did. What they did mainly, they've sort of accredited this to, you know, the help they gave with COVID and whatever. But really what it is, and they say this, I used to get so many complaints about from people who'd been APSA clients who'd been defrauded, and the bank just didn't want to know their story, as many still continue not to, although they sometimes give a 50% and you'll go away, you know. But APSA introduced this, they call it the digital fraud warranty. When I heard about this, I thought, I don't know how this is going to work. It's going to cost the bank far too much. But my complaints just about, well, 50 fraud ones just dried up because they pay. They've just built it into their business model. And you can see it in the numbers, because most complaints to this banking ombuds office are fraud-related, sadly, in all categories. And so that's really interesting to see it coming out in the numbers. And the other two banks going in the opposite direction. It must be said that all the other big banks did have slightly more cases opened in 2020 than they did the year before, but not as dramatic as F&B and Capitec. So I would imagine, and one would hope, that they'd be looking very hard and long at their processes and the training of their people to try and get those numbers back down to what they were previously.
How important is the overall size of the bank in terms of retail customers? The two biggest retail banks, of course, are Capitec. They sign up 160,000 new customers every single month. You would expect them, with over 15 million customers, to have a higher number of complaints. And FNB also went on a massive customer acquisition drive a couple of years ago. Again, you'd expect them to have a higher number of absolute complaints relative, because they've got customers.
Absolutely. So that's why I was looking at the difference in their particular complaints year on year, rather than comparing them just straight on numbers with other banks, because they're obviously important. But the trend in number of cases from one particular bank to this complaints to this office does tell a story. And clearly FNB and Capitec aren't going to be issuing any press releases about that, as APSA has seen fit to do, because their numbers look good. So it's comparing apples and apples in the sense that it's looking at how each bank is performing now. One other thing, if we've got time, and I just think it's worth mentioning, is that the I love it when the ombuds offices include case studies in their report, because they really do tell the stories better than the numbers. The OBS put 15 case studies in their report, and many of them were so interesting to me, because the work that I do come out of the was cases where the ombud ruled and came down in favor of the complainant, not the bank, because the bank failed to properly advise their customer about a very real threat. So that's a huge red flag for the banks, that they really need to communicate these things properly, because if it goes to the ombud and the ombud finds out you didn't do right by your customer in terms of communication, they are going to be paying out.
Good news. Thank you very much, Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, on a Wednesday night here on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This Shapeshifters feature is brought to you by Momentum Corporate. Momentum, here for you on your journey to success.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Do you remember the days when beer was Lion Lager and Olsen's and Castle and Black Label, and then Lex Mitchell started a mini revolution in Neisner, and he produced Foresters and he produced a bitter? And then suddenly, at some point, there was an explosion. There were some guys in Nottingham Road producing some glorious beers in the late 1990s. But the craft beer movement really started exploding in the mid sort of noughties, if you like. Jack Black came to the market in 2007. You weren't first, Ross McCullough, co-founder of Jack Black, but certainly you've lasted. What is it? What's Castle's thing? The taste that stood the test of time. You're the craft that stood the test of time. By craft beer terms, you've done well. You've been around since 2007.
Thanks, Bruce. Good evening, and thanks for inviting. We launched in 2007, and we are still holding on and actually putting up a good fight these days, which is great and optimistic, and it's been a fun ride so far. Sometimes it feels like it's been 1 year, and other times it feels like a lifetime. But we are still around and kicking, and seen quite a few breweries in the industry come and go over our time.
It's a family business. I mean, I'm assuming Meg is your wife or your sister. Both.
Definitely my wife.
Okay, just checking. You guys, it's a family business. You started in 2007. Does either one of you have any brewing experience at that point?
Very basic home brewing experience, but more experience, the experience that we brought to Jack Black was a passion for sales, a passion for beer, and across our two skills, Meg, my wife, is the co-founder, and has been in the business the whole time, and is still in the business very actively, doing a lot of our all of our marketing. She's our director of marketing. So what we brought to the business was sales and marketing, and then we ended up actually being a lot of our first few years was a focus on distribution. We didn't come with brewmaster certification, but a basic understanding of the brewing process.
What made you think that you could come into a market that was exploding at the time with startups and actually succeed if you don't even know how to really make the product on an industrial scale?
I was based in Canada for a number of years, working for a very large family-owned winery out of the United States and out of California. And I came home to visit family members every other year. And, we were in my role in sales in North America. I saw that in South Africa there was a good amount of wine, of course, but beer was craft beer was sorely lacking, and something that was very in a high growth curve within North America. So it started. I've always had a passion for beer, and I was selling wine during the day, but having a beer at the end of the day, and we saw this opportunity that was happening around the world, and not much. At that time in South Africa, rightly so, Mitchell's and a few others, Birkenhead, Boston breweries, were in the Cape, were in existence, but not really. At that time they were struggling, and we thought that our concept and what we wanted to do would we'd give a crack at it, because we really sincerely thought that craft beer would take hold, and to our luck it did in the following years.
There was a bit of luck, but of course, I mean, SAB's great success was based on strong dominant brands, which you don't have, but I mean, you didn't have at the time. And the other secret of SAB's success was distribution. They could get, I mean, the old joke of, you know, you should get the Department of Education to distribute liquor and SAB to distribute school books, and you'd solve the drinking problem and the education problem in one fell swoop. Distribution is the secret. And you said a moment ago that that was a very, you know, once you brewed the stuff and it's sitting in your warehouse floor, your brewery floor, you've then got to get it to market.
Yes. So our, initially our focus was, you know, we came in thinking, well, let's you know, put our beer into a bottle and try to sell it to anybody who would take it. But we quickly realized that it was very crowded with the big players, SAB, Heineken, and the big brands in the market, Distell. And so it was quite difficult to get traction within liquor stores. So we then started focusing on the restaurants or on-trade area of the business. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, draft was not, beer on tap was not that prevalent. It was, you know, it was quite established in well-established drinking, you know, sports bars and big drinking, bars. But, you know, a lot of restaurants didn't have beer on tap. And there was a real need at that time to get beer on tap, and a lot of consumers were asking for beer on tap. So we came in at the right time and asked a few of the right questions and quickly realized that if we could offer our beer on tap to a restaurant, they would take it because the bigger players were not offering them such a, you know, such a service or a product, because ultimately, you know, the breweries supply the equipment that dispenses the beer. So we would have, you know, scrape up our pennies and put together the draft equipment and install it into the customer's account. And so if we could do that, they would take our beer quite readily. And the beautiful part about that was, you know, once a consumer walks into the bar and sees a tap on the counter dispensing fresh, cold beer, they're quite they're open to changing their, you know, their usual brand out for something that's on tap. So that, you know, from 2008, that was our sole focus. And we've had that focus up until today. And in the future, we're looking at, you know, we continue to focus on beer on tap, pouring a great product, fresh product, cold product in a bar. And that still makes up about 70% of our sales. So, you know, that was our, you know, our approach. It was quite simple. But it worked, and I think it worked because of that focus. And you know, we didn't have any money or much budget.
What was the startup capital? I mean, was that out of family savings? Was it the friends, fools, and everybody else?
We had about 200,000 rand that we brought from Canada, and we couldn't afford to build a brewery, so we actually did what's quite common now and all over the world. We contract brewed. So we took our recipe that we developed in Canada and we took it to one of the local breweries, Birkenhead in Stanford, and then we moved to Boston subsequently. And that was, you know, so they brewed the beer for us, and that allowed us to focus on the sales, the distribution, the tap installations, and you know, slowly work from there. And I think if we'd taken on production right out the gate, especially with you know, I'm not, as we've mentioned before, not a qualified brewmaster, it would have been too distracting from, you know, the sales and distribution functions that we needed to perform. So that was, I think, kind of a blessing in disguise, not having enough money to put our own brewery together initially.
I mean, for a long time, you seem to have just a single product, which is a very nice but very light brewer's lager, call it. But I mean, and for a long time, that Jack Black was just that. You've diversified considerably since then. But I mean, how long did you have just that single product in market?
So we started with lager. And you're absolutely right. We did introduce a pale ale a couple of years later, but it was a lot slower growth on that product, even though there was a lot of consumers really enjoyed it and were very passionate about the product.
It's delicious, yes.
And I mean, the challenge was we wanted,
It's delicious, but the category had to grow. And if you're not used to a full-flavored beer, if you're not used to the floral notes, and if you're not used to sort of fruitiness in a beer, you're going to think to yourself, hold on a second, I bought a beer, I didn't buy a fruit punch, whatever the case might be, whatever flavor profile you get out of it. And your market had to mature as well, I think, to appreciate the fact that there are multiple styles, and within the styles, huge variations in flavor profile.
Yes, absolutely. And we're still, the market is still, you know, developing today. 13 years on, we're still in that phase where there's a lot of, a lot of education and trial of consumers and trying different things. But yes, lager is still our dominant SKU or variant. And I think for obvious reasons too, you know, that we are it's a warm country. Lager is the dominant, style of beer here, most definitely. So, you know, that's why we launched with the lager. We didn't launch with, in the U.S., for reference, the U.S., the largest style of craft beer is an India Pale Ale, which is an extremely hoppy, high alcohol product. That's the biggest style. But in South Africa, where the weather's warm and SAB and the big brands dominate with lager styles, we decided to come in with lager that was, distinctly different, but still approachable, and understandable to the consumer. And then slowly release products as we went along. And actually, interesting, some of the things that really hindered, launching new products was the fact that we couldn't keep up, within our contracts. We couldn't expand quick enough. We just didn't have the product, enough product to sell. So we had to focus primarily on the lager. But when we built our brewery in Cape Town in Deep River in 2016, it allows us, we built in, excess capacity and allowed us to, to branch out into a number of styles. So that's been, been very positive. Some of them have, not worked, which is totally understandable. And some of them, we've seen some fantastic growth. So that innovation has been great. And, we're taking our loyal Jack Black consumers on a journey, and also introducing new consumers, through beers like wheat beer or weiss beer, which is, low hop, slightly, so low bitterness, banana type flavors, nice flavors, very approachable. You could almost say, sweeter type beers that, new craft beer consumers quite enjoy. So it's a fun journey, and it's still to this day very exciting watching, somebody who's been drinking lager their whole lives try something new and their eyes, open wide and say, what have I been missing? I've been drinking lager moment. My whole life. it's a eureka moment, so that's always fun.
More with the Jack Black co-founder, Ross McCullough, in a moment. We're talking about our shapeshifter this evening, Ross McCullough. He and his wife, Meg, started the Jack Black Brewing Company in 2007 with not much money, with not much brewing experience, with a recipe and a whole bunch of chutzpah. And we're going to find out how they've survived for the last 14 years through two recessions and are still standing. More on that in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Many other brewers have come and gone, but Jack Black has stood the test of time. You've been around since 2007. You've gone through two recessions. Today, you've got your own tap room. You're doing venues and food and drinks and entertainment, in addition to providing the beer. I mean, it's become actually, quite a nicely well-rounded business. And I'm assuming now you are brewing your own beer. You're not reliant on third-party producers.
Yes, we are. You've done your homework, Bruce. we not just brewing our own, but we're also doing some other contracts for, you know, other brewers and helping them out, particularly at this time, you know, and where they've had to slow down their facilities, you know, or put them, you know, not mothball them, but, you know, temporarily cease operations. You know, we've stepped in and helped a couple of guys. So that's also been great. But as you said, it is that's what keeps us going every day, is how interesting the business is, and you know, all the facets of it, from the tap room, like you say, having a restaurant, having a brand home, having consumers come in and try all our different beers, to the sales portion of it. Of course, the marketing side is a lot of fun, and the brewing, which is the heart of our business, and really having, you know, it's been a fantastic step moving into our own brewery, a very expensive step, but a fantastic step nonetheless. And it's given us a lot of more control over our brewing process than we had, you know, before. And given us capacity to allow us to innovate, which has been, you know, really something which is very important in business, you know, to focus, but at the same time, innovate. And not innovation, when we say innovation, it doesn't just mean launch, you know, as many new products as you can. It's about looking at your existing products and refining them and improving them and keeping them relevant to the consumer and to your, you know, to our fans.
What hasn't worked? You said you've tried different things and some haven't worked and some have worked. Obviously, the ones that have worked, and including your Skeleton Coast Pale Ale, which my colleague John Perlman tells me is his favourite. IPA, I beg your pardon, India Pale Ale. What hasn't worked? I mean, I don't see a dark beer, the Dunkelbier, which is, Germans seem to like that for some reason. I'm not sure it's madly popular here.
It's not that sad. I mean, we've moved it out of, you know, all year round production. And that is a product that we have called Lumberjack. And Lumberjack is very close to our hearts. It was one of the, I think it was product number four that we launched. And it's an amber ale. It's dark, rich, it's still got a high hopping rate. But there's so much malt character in it. So it's quite a heavy beer. It's a winter style beer.
Made for a rainy winter's night in Cape Town. That's what it's there for, yeah.
Yes. And a lot of Cape Townians like to go to wine over winter. the sales of Lumberjack have, you know, we've got some real passionate fans on that. And you can see it because it still ticks over, but it's something that, you know, we may move to a seasonal product rather. So that's just, you know, one of the things. And we've tried a few things in our tap room. You know, we have a small little pilot system that we try some products in the tap room, and if people turn up their noses and we don't follow through with it. But we let the brewers loose on our pilot system and they have some fun, and we test it out on some of our consumers. and most of the time it works. So that's a lot of fun. Yeah.
I mean, what's next? I mean, you're helping out some competitors. You're keeping the category going. And you know, the health minister today is saying that the third wave is upon us. That must meet you with a fair amount of apprehension, as hopefully we don't see lockdowns and booze bans and everything else that has really made your life difficult over the last 12 months.
I've got some of that fatigue, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure.
On it, but. Yeah, you know, as we spoke last time about, you know, when we're coming out of a lockdown, you know, as I mentioned, it's planning and replanning and replanning and replanning, and we've become quite good at it, which has been great. But you know, what's next for us is one of the silver linings they talk about during COVID, and you know, when in our first lockdown, the hard lockdown, we really started to think about projects that we had been thinking about, but you know, didn't have time to execute on. And, we started to develop a new product, which we've just launched into the market. It's called Southfield's Hard Seltzer. And that is a category that has been growing globally for the last few years and is just coming to South Africa's shores now. So You know, some of the big guys have also launched their hard seltzers. So that's a new, it's quite different to craft beer, but it's something that we can, you know, we can produce in our facility. So making use of that. And, you know, it's a completely different offering. It's a light, low calorie, low sugar, vegan friendly product that is, you know, that is in line with some of the trends that are happening in the marketplace, the, you know, the low and no alcohol trends, the wellness trends. So we've kind of gone, you know, we've looked at the other side of the coin and said, well, how these consumers, we don't want to neglect these consumers with a big IPA, you know? So let's do something different. So that's exciting for us. And, you know, the trade has been very accepting of that product, which is fantastic. Now we'll see how the consumer reacts in South Africa. And then we've got some other, you know, we are again looking at the low and no alcohol category and some further innovations in this year, towards the end of this year. You know, what's been very positive for us and how we got through this and how we'll continue to get through this is our very positive relationship with and partnership with Heineken. We, you know, how we got through this was with them on our side, thank goodness. You know, we realized a couple of years ago that the biggest part of my day was tackling distribution challenges. And you know, how do we solve these challenges? So I picked up the phone and I spoke to one of the biggest
distributors. Don't get. I mean, I think that's the point. Ross, we've got to leave it there. I'm so sorry that we have to cut.
Absolutely.
But thank you for a lovely chat. Ross McCullough this evening on The Money Show, the founder of Jack Black. Life has a habit of bowling googlies that knock us off balance. Momentum Corporate protects your employees and their families from financial risks of unexpected life events like disability, death or critical illness. When you protect your employees, you protect your business. Contact Momentum Corporate or your financial advisor to help you move in the right direction. Momentum Corporate is part of Momentum Metropolitan Life Limited, an authorized financial services and registered credit provider.